Blog Talk Radio. It's time for Peach State Pandemonium, brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com, where we discuss the past, present, and future of professional wrestling in Georgia and beyond. We bring you the latest news and upcoming events and speak to legends, upcoming stars, and key people in between. Now here's your host, Rich Tate.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the return of Peach State Pandemonium. It's good to be with you, and we're glad to ring in 2009 with James J.J. Dillon showing up here in just a little bit, and, of course, Les Thatcher with me. Les, how you doing tonight?
I'm good, Rich. How about yourself?
I'm doing all right. How were the holidays for you, sir?
They were just holidays. You know, when you get old, they're just another day. No, it was fine. You know, it was okay. How about yourself?
It was pretty good. Tim, how about yours?
Oh, they were very nice. It was a long downtime for me, about 3 weeks, and kind of hard to get it cranked back up this week. And
you know what, Tim? I don't know about you, but damages starts tonight at 10 o'clock.
Oh, yeah. So I'm so excited.
Do you know why? Do you know, have both of you seen the show Damages?
Yeah, no.
No, I'll tell you, great. I mean, great drama, seriously. Glenn Close is a star. It was a series last year, and it starts its second season tonight on FX. And if you want to see, I mean, something that gets you on the edge of your seat and you can't wait till the next show, it's a great show to watch. Starts at 10.
So we trust you'll be Devo in the first half hour, right?
Of course. You're more important than anything that might entertain me, Rich.
There you go. Well, guys, a lot's happened in the last couple of weeks. I got to admit, I'm not as prepared for the show tonight as I would like to have been. As Tim said, going back to work after the holidays has been a little bit nuts, and I can definitely agree with that. I did not have a lot of time to prep for the show, but just many things that we know have happened, and you guys throw out anything you got, and we'll definitely be open to calls tonight. 347-324-5735 is the number. Of course, as I mentioned, we are glad to be back, and James J.J. Dillon will be with us tonight, and we also have a big announcement coming up that we'll disclose that around after we speak with J.J. Guys, have you had a chance to listen to any of the shows that debuted this week as part of our new network?
I haven't.
No, I haven't either.
Okay.
How about you, Rich?
Well, I've listened to them both, and let me tell you, I was glad that nobody came knocking on the door today handing me any sort of papers. Of course, Dan Masters debuted last night, so I'm waiting for the attorneys at this point from anybody, You know how things are with him. But, yeah, it was a good show. He had Nigel Sherrod on, and there's a possibility that Nigel will be co-hosting with him. He talked to him about that today. As a matter of fact, that was kind of a off-the-cuff thing that they had on last night. Nigel just happened to call in and as the show began and sat in with him for the whole show. And they just sounded great together, what they were doing. And then, of course, Rick Gillespie and Casey Trowbridge doing the MMA show on Sunday night. Of course, the debut of the Jimmy Rave show did not happen, and we can't really go into the reasons for that, but that's been pushed back, and we hope to have that on soon. And, of course, the Nosebleed section debuts next Thursday. So a lot of things going on, and then, of course...
You know something I want to throw out? We've been talking about Peach State Pandemonium or Georgia Wrestling History in Cornelia in March on the 21st... 21st, but you should better talk about it on the 22nd. You want it on Saturday, right?
Exactly. Right.
Yeah. I know.
Yeah,
somebody...
we've already started getting some good feedback from all of our contributors and folks. And
Good.
Pretty
but
sure,
anyway,
sure
that
Tim's
Saturday is the 22nd. That's the night of the taping, and we're going to train all day Saturday and
right.
And all that. And you're bringing tights too, right, Rich?
Oh, you know it, man. I'm getting in the ring.
Yeah, all right. That's worth the price of admission. Anybody's listening.
Yeah, everybody bring your cameras for that. Nobody wants to see me in tights, much less wrestling.
Have you guys checked out the Waxman papers?
I've read through some of it. It's been a little crazy this week, so I've not had as much time as I would like. I hope to by next week. What have you gotten out of it?
a lot of fiction.
Yeah.
That's what I got out of it. It's, you know, I'll never live long enough to read it all. I mean, if you, you know, there's I don't know how many hundreds of pages there, but you know, in essence, people are trying to cover their rear ends, I guess. You know, but when you hear somebody say, "I've never heard steroids discussed," where have you been hiding? If you've never heard them discussed, I mean, you know, it's just. It's there, you know, and it's not just wrestling. I get tired of hearing that. It's like, you know, we're the bad guys. It's not just wrestling. It's across the board. People are competitive, legal or illegal. If somebody, you know, I was having a discussion the other night, and I said, you know, as fast as somebody comes up with these designer drugs, there's somebody else coming up with a way to mask them in a test.
Mm-hmm.
So, and the HGH, you can't, you know, some people say there's a test for it, but I've yet to see it. You know, it's there. It's going to be there. You know, there's contradicting statements across the board. But like I say, everybody's trying to cover the rear end. But it really makes the industry look kind of soft. Dixie Carter comes across as in over her head, quite frankly.
Yeah, I did read part of her Q&A. When it was first made public, and I got to tell you, there were moments where she seemed aloof, yet there were also moments where she seemed to have just a great business mind about how to handle some of the questions. Other times, she seemed like, you know, if you were there, you'd be kind of watching her twitch in her seat, I guess.
Well, you know, listen, I'm, you know, to me, they're illegal. That start across the board. You know, is the government going to do anything about it? I doubt it. The government's getting a lot of negative feedback about messing with baseball and so forth, which is a far more important part of the American, you know, fabric than our business is anyway. But you know, like what was it, 40% of the roster tested positive for something or another in their first run at it, and nobody was penalized for anything, you know. Which even sounds more stupid than you're not testing at all,
right? Hey,
you know, it's well, like, you know, like UFC, you get nailed in a drug test, it's a year suspension.
Right. Hey, Tim, what became of the NFL thing that was going on that had I believe Grady Jackson was a part of that. What came of that here recently?
I have yet to. I think that is yet to be determined. I think that's TBA. But getting back to the Waxman thing. As I started reading it, you only had to go in two paragraphs to hear him mention Chris Benoit. And that, you know, then it's a buzzword now. You associate one with the other. I mean, it's easy. It's easy. It comes off the tongue. It flows. But it makes absolutely no sense, as we know. But you know, Henry Waxman, being a former chairman of the Energy and Commerce Committee,
right?
Something like that.
Why is, if we're going to talk about steroids or performance, I love this term, performance enhancing drugs. Okay, I don't know where the two meet, but anyway, why isn't that under the guise of the Surgeon General? Or
wow,
some other a medical.
Because he's too busy collecting under the table from cigarette manufacturers.
Probably that's. I'm not going to deny that point. You know, and, but
I mean, you know, it's well, you know, here's the crazy thing too. You know what? Here, whether it's wrestling or track and field or baseball or football or basketball or whatever the hell it happens to be. What everybody's got to understand is the guys who reach the pinnacle of those particular pursuits all have one thing in common, and that is a competitive spirit, right? That's how they got there. And if I tell you to eat cabbage and that'll make you better at than somebody else, you know, that's what made somebody else beat you at a certain game, then you'll eat cabbage. if you want to be better. You know, if it's going to improve your chance of making more money or improve your performance or enhance whatever, then you're going to give it a shot. Guys, you know, I was a competitive bodybuilder. I've worked with the pro bodybuilders, and the craziest thing in the world is this: a few years back, there was just a question asked some guys, you know, if I could give you a drug that would make you the best bodybuilder on the face of the earth, but it was going to kill you, would you take it? And some guys said, yeah. And you got to understand, that's the mindset. You know, my biggest fear with all this stuff, listen, the guys who can afford the HGH also have somebody probably monitoring them. I mean, that's an, you know, but the HGH has to be usually enhanced with something as stacked, is the expression, you know, with something else, with an anabolic of some sort. Here's the biggest problem. These kids, and I've had them come through my gym, who, you know, they walk in the door, they lay down their money, and 15 minutes later they say, should I be on drugs? I mean, they've never lifted a weight, they've never eaten properly in their life, and they don't even know if they can be a wrestler. But should they be on drugs? You should just, you know, maybe find out what your potential in everything else is. As a competitive bodybuilder, I've never used steroids, and if I had them, I wouldn't have a problem saying that I had in the past, but I haven't. But anyway, the point is, you can get in shape and you can stay in good shape without the drugs, but it's harder. It absolutely is harder. And with the road schedule a lot of these guys have, there lies part of the hook too. But you know, the funny thing is, too many people think, well, you pop a pill or you stick a needle in your rear end and sit down and watch television and you right away look like, you know, Mr. America. That's not true either. That's hard work and diet and, you know, and lifting and you know, it's a combination of all things. The drugs enhance that. But the point is, with the kids at entry level or at the independent level, for the most, you know, I work with bodybuilders. I've helped them train. I've helped them set nutritional diets. Plus I've competed myself. But the point is, in talking to DEA agents and in being around this a little bit, the trouble is the kids who don't have the kind of money that the big stars have, who maybe are using the HGH, it's untraceable, is they're buying something out of some trunk of somebody's car. First of all, they probably don't know what they're buying. Second of all, they're probably not sure how to use it, except somebody else is telling them, well, I heard this, or I read this, or this or that. They can't afford or can't find a doctor who will take the risk of monitoring them, so they have no way of checking. You know, again, the guys with the money, you know, they're going to have – there are jock-sniffing physicians. Well, you got one right down there, right?
Oh, yeah.
Who's I mean, you know, and that's, again, that's like the governor of Illinois. It's not like he invented, you know, selling a Senate seat. He's just the guy who got caught.
Right.
But, you know, I mean, because this has been ongoing since, well, the first time I ever saw any anabolics was back, gosh, mid-60s, I guess. You know, Dianabol was the first thing to come around. But anyway, they have no way of being monitored by a physician to check, you know, they're probably using too much or they don't know how to use it properly. And again, they're not sure. I had a DEA agent tell me years ago that, you know, he said, personally, if they use it properly and they're monitored, I don't have a problem with that. He said, but if you went into some of these bogus labs that we bust and saw how dirty they are and everything, you know, so Lord knows what's going through that needle or it's in those pills. That's the other thing, too. So, and again, you know, there are guys out there who are in shape without, you know, without that. And is it harder? Of course it is. But the other thing is too many kids say, well, if I have a great body, I'll be a top flight wrestler. No, you'll just be a guy with a great body. You got to learn to, you know, it's a combination of things.
And so that's why I say the performance enhancing part of it in the wrestling business is just, it's absurd. Your performance is enhanced by your ability to work.
Yes. Not, yes. Well, you know, Tim, I'll tell you something else. That's like Barry Bonds. Did he or didn't he? I don't really know, and personally don't really care. But the other part of that is, if he can't hit that the major league curveball or 95 mile an hour fastball, I don't give a damn how many drugs he's on. He's not going to have that many home runs.
And I've never heard of a drug that can make your eyesight stronger other than carotene.
No. and there are long term effects. You know, that's been proven too. But the thing with Benoit, that with Chris, it was, my God, it was a combination of things. You know. And you can't blame Royd Regis if that's something it's there and gone. That's like a mood swing, or you hit your finger with a hammer and you scream and holler for a minute or something and wave your hand in the air and yell obscenities and it's over. That's simplifying it, obviously, but Royd Regis doesn't last for an entire weekend. That's the point.
The other thing about the leather guys, I think we ought to point out, is the comments of Stephanie McMahon Levesque and the no-show appearance of Vincent K. McMahon, and the comments that he did make, as far as did he or is he availed to testing? And he said no, because he's not on a regular performer, and he might perform on the roster maybe twice a year. But then they asked him the question, had he used performance-enhancing drugs, I believe the statement was, since 1996 was the date that I read. Could
and
be wrong
he refused
the
to answer.
And he refused to answer.
Yeah.
Well, kind of like Mark McGwire.
Well, I'll tell you guys, I'm not going to name any names or anything, but I have a physician friend who we are basically the same age, 47. We've known each other all our lives, and he will tell me to my face that, Tim, you could take a cc of testosterone every day for the rest of your life and there would be no ill effects. Not that not that I questioned him or asked him about it. He just said that at 47 you could do that.
Well, you know, here's something too, guys. In the sports section of our Sunday paper, at least every other week or so, there's an ad with a picture of a doctor standing in his jeans, and he is in tremendous shape. This guy's like 61 or 62, and he's a doctor. And this talks about, life enhancement and, lowering your body fat, increasing muscle mass, and this and that. Well, what do you think they're talking about? And in certain capacities, it's legal. Now, again, when you talk about performance enhancing, it's like you go to NASCAR and if they, they have a cubic inch limit or, whatever, there's certain limits. And then if you exceed those, then you're going to, you'll have more performance. Okay, so I see the value in that. But again, we're talking about physically enhancing, and again, I'm not sitting here condoning it, and obviously it is illegal. At one point it was not, but again, they've also proven that there's some long-term effects on that, and the biggest problem with that, too, to me, with the kids at the lower level is you're not sure you're going anyplace. Now, let me say this. I'm too old, but today, if you wave seven figures in front of me, would I be tempted to do anabolics? I don't know for sure. I may, but I've never been in that position. So, and when I did competitive bodybuilding, it was in master's division. I didn't start till I was 47. And, I've had guys say to me, well, you could have placed a spot higher. Or you could have been tighter if you were doing this or that. First of all, it didn't make any sense to win a $50 trophy to spend several hundred dollars on something, and I'm in good health, and to roll the dice. I'm just not a gambler in that respect. But for these kids at a low level to waste their money and their time and risk their health is just crazy. And that worries me more than, Barry Bonds or somebody in WWE for that matter, because chances are they're being monitored by a doctor and at least, have a fair chance of coming out of it without any harm.
Hmm.
guys still there? Or am I boring you to death with it?
Yeah, no. Well, we're expecting JJ on the line here in a second. So let's kind of shift over to something else while we wait on him to come up here. Just real quick, just want to say that, you know, Tim and I apologize, but back in September prior to the NFL season, we incorrectly prognosticated the Falcons season. I think Tim gave them 7 wins. I gave them 8. And, well, you know, we were wrong. Tim, how bad do you feel about being wrong?
We're big enough to admit when we're wrong. And we didn't look down on them.
The Falcons have had a good season in the first time in what century?
Oh,
and
yeah.
You guys are sitting there crowing like they're the Boston Celtics or something.
Well, you know, Les, what it is at this point is I've never seen a franchise in such dismal state. You know, other than maybe the Lions right now, I've never seen an organization so disorganized. And to 1 year come back, I mean, granted they had a, you know, relatively easy schedule, but they did play some competitive teams, and I think counting Carolina twice, I think they ended up playing like 6 games, 7 games against playoff teams. Won a few of those, and I think they made a statement this year, and I think they have turned a corner, and sadly, I can't believe I'm having to say this for a franchise that's been around for more than 40 years now, but we might actually have back-to-back winning seasons next year.
That will, you know, be the.
It's kind of been a funny football season across the board. Look at Miami, where they came from. You know,
right.
Nobody expect really. Baltimore kind of sputtered at the beginning. Nobody expected them to be where they're at right now. Everybody expected Dallas to be so much stronger, and with Tom Brady out, the Pats at 11-5 couldn't make the playoffs.
Well, Les, one thing I do know is nobody expected anything out of the Bengals, so you probably don't feel bad about that.
Well, but, you know what? If I were a Bengal fan, I might be offended by that, but I'm
right.
Not. I'm a Redskins fan. They came out of the gate strong, but sputtered on the other end.
And then they folded. And Tim, we do have JJ on the line, but just real quick, I know you'd like to make at least one statement about what they did, and I wanted to ask you real quick. I meant to call you earlier this week and ask you if you could maybe do a little research on this, but are they the first team, or how many other teams can honestly say in the NFL that they've never had a back-to-back winning season?
I would think that we are the only franchise that has not had back-to-back winning season. And real quick before we go, Les, you were saying, you know, how many years has it been? Just to put this in context, okay, the Dallas Cowboys in 12 years – have played in 3 less playoff games than the Atlanta Falcons. That just shows you how just, you know, either or the Falcons have been not to have back-to-back winning seasons.
Yeah.
Well, all I can say is, yeah, we're crowing a little bit, but, you know, from where we came, this was definitely a good season. Let's move on now. Let's bring our guest on the line. He had a book out just a few years ago, Wrestlers Are Like Seagulls, From McMahon to McMahon, and you can find that at onewrestlinglegends.com by Scott Teal's Crowbar Press. JJ, how you doing tonight, sir?
Great. How are you?
Very good. Good to have you on the line. We got Les and Tim Dix here also. Guys?
Jimmy, how you doing?
It's good. Happy New Year to you, my friend, because I haven't had a chance. This is our first conversation in the new year.
Yes, you too, my friend. Something I bet these guys don't know. We'll give them a little trivia to start the ball rolling here. JJ and I were tag team partners as babyfaces in the Carolinas.
I'd have to get a calculator out to figure how many years ago it was, but it was quite a few. And I was, you know, I started full-time late life in the business. I wasn't like a 16, 18-year-old kid like some of them. I was when I went to Charlotte, It was the spring of 1971, so I was months from my 29th birthday, and of course I met a young Les Thatcher there, and he kind of took me under his wing and taught me the right way to do things on the road as a full-time professional, and helped me out of a few jams that we can't talk about on the air, and was there to kind of lead me on a night-to-night basis. And I think that experience as a babyface served me well, you know, on down the line with the years to come.
I want to say that he was a heck of a worker. You know, that's something a lot of people don't know. In fact, I'm trying to think. JJ, we had a conversation with somebody. Was it in Mobile or someplace where, or maybe it was when we had with Doc Young, and he said, well, I saw you wrestle as a manager and you weren't very good. And JJ had to tell him, he said, well, you know, I wasn't supposed to be good as a manager. Tell him the story. Tell him the story about Houston, about you, you know, filling in one night. And how Bosch jumped on you about being too good as a manager.
Oh, boy. Yeah, I always felt that I didn't have a big ego. And I think everybody, to be a success in any profession, has to have somewhat of an ego, but especially in the wrestling business and all professional sports, sometimes you see egos that, you know, take control of the individual. But I always thought that I had mine in check. And my dream was to be a professional wrestler. I chased my dream. I was very lucky in that I, you know, often was the right place, the right time, which, you know, that's the luck part of it, in addition to whatever talent you may be blessed with. And I had a lot of help because I had a great attitude. And I wanted to be a wrestler. And I had some success, even though I wasn't blessed with a bodybuilder's type body, you know, not the most talented. I could talk because I knew that that's where my money was and that's what I concentrated on. And I never really thought about ever managing. And it wasn't until I got a call from the Stomper Archie Goldie after I'd been in the business wrestling 4 or 5 years. And he had a unique situation where he had a top spot in Dallas that he could go into. And he needed a needed a manager, and he had seen me up in the Maritimes, seen me in Florida, liked my interviews, and so I took him up on that opportunity, and of course it opened up a whole new chapter to my career. But in the back of my mind, you know, in the beginning, it was new. It was a new challenge. I loved it. And then after a while, I started doing some gimmick matches where, you know, the manager, you know, gets forced into the ring. And so Houston was the best town in the territory where you really, I mean, Dallas, the other towns were good, but Houston's where you made your big bucks with Paul Bosch. He was one of the best payoff men in the business. And he worked me into some scenarios where I was in the ring and I was in one of the co-feature matches or whatever. Stomper, I think, was against Jose Lothario or something. And Gino Hernandez was still alive, of course, and a big star at that point. And so I was booked against Gino Hernandez. And I had in my mind, you know, looking around the dressing room, I'm thinking, you know, a lot of these guys, you know, in just 5 years don't know that I, you know, was a fair hand myself. And it was, the one time that I think my ego got the best of me. And I went out that night with the idea in mind to show the guys in the dressing room, especially those that had never seen me as a wrestler, to show them that you know, that I could perform at a level that might surprise them. So I went out and, you know, with Gino, tried, you know, and again, you lose some of your sharpness not doing it on an every night basis, but, you know, I was out there trying to do everything crisp and just to show them that I was a top worker. And when the match was over, you know, I came back all full of myself, walked into the dressing room, and there's Paul Bosch, and I can immediately see by the look on his face that he was not happy. And it wasn't until he started to explain to me how the fans that were there that night that bought tickets, you know, had an expectation of what they were going to get from me, and that I was a manager. I was not supposed to be very courageous. I was not supposed to be very tough. I was not supposed to be very polished. And I went out there and made an attempt to do the exact opposite of what they expected. And so I basically failed in my role that night. And he was right, and I was wrong. And I learned a valuable, valuable lesson. And that's why, as Les is telling that story, if somebody comes up to me and says, I saw you wrestle and you weren't very good as a wrestling manager, I now know to take that as a tremendous compliment.
Good stuff. Just want to remind everybody, too, if you'd like to get in here and talk to JJ, the number is 347-324-5735. We've got open lines, so feel free to call in and talk to him. JJ, I got to tell you, man, your book, it was an amazing read. I know we've talked about that before via email. We've never actually spoken on the phone before, but you know, I fell in love with that book, and I think I've read it about 5 times. It amazed me just how much detail you could bring up, and you know, you pointed out early in the book that early in your career you decided to start keeping a daily journal, and you know, how valuable was that in putting the book together? I mean, could you have possibly
priceless, priceless. I don't think I ever anticipated when I started, you know, and why I saved them, I don't know. And of course, I'm thankful that I did, because it was kind of a record that kind of refreshed my memory about, you know, you go to a lot of places where you go back to territory a couple times, and then you're trying to joggle in your memory as to, well, was I there in the territory with this guy this time around, or was it the next time around? And then it kind of runs together, and so this was really, you know, it reminded me of who the specific guys, because I would talk about the match, the town, the date, the match, you know, what I got paid, all the details. So, I mean, it was a huge help to me. And as I look at my book, I'm very proud of it. It's still probably one of the best kept secrets in the business, because Scott Teal, co-authored it, and he also, it was his publishing company that published it.
Right.
It's not available in a bookstore, so you've got to go to either my website or his website and do a little work to find it. And the original printing was, I think, you know, only 3,000 hardbound copies, of which there's probably still 1,000 left out there, which means in all the wrestling population, you know, only about 2,000 copies have been sold. And, of course, a lot of people probably hand them off to other people that have read it. But given the reviews that I've gotten back, to have that kind of response from, you know, only a couple thousand copies is pretty gratifying as well.
Yeah, it is.
You know,
let
me say something, Rich, Tim. When you brought up his eye for detail, and there's something that, you know, I've had guys, you know, younger guys, and Doc Young used to say to me on Wrestling Weekly, you're always crossing your T's, dotting your I's, but that's something that our generation learned. And that's something that I think one of the things that weakens the storylines today, because they don't lay out a storyline or an angle or call it whatever you want over a period of time and then backtrack and fill in the credibility gaps. They just do it, and you can shoot holes in it almost every week. And I think that's something that lacks today that was drummed into our heads when we were kids breaking into the business.
Yeah, Leslie, you make a great point, because, you know, the wrestling business, the excuse always seems to be, well, we can take the creative liberty to do this or to do that. And that's a convenient way of saying, you know, we can do whatever, you know, we want. But at the same time, the logic of everything is what really made, you know, wrestling and the ongoing storyline so palatable. And it was even more critical when in the smaller territories you had smaller population centers, you were wrestling in towns on a weekly basis. So however many people you had in the arena on any given Tuesday night in Tampa or Thursday night in Amarillo, or those same people, it was important to have your performance be at a level that those people left getting value for the money spent, that the credibility was there, and that you hoped that every one of those same people would come back next week because of your efforts, and at the same time that they would tell someone else, you know, hey, you know, you should have been in the Amarillo Sports Arena Thursday night. I saw something like I thought I'd never see before, or the same thing in Tampa. And nowadays, you know, the major promotions are going to major population centers, and I predicted in my book towards the end that I think the World Wrestling Federation /WWE would eventually go the way of like the Harlem Globetrotters, where they would be strictly an entertainment novelty thing that wasn't structured to come back on a weekly basis. I mean, even when I was there in the early 90s, they were still running Madison Square Garden every third week and selling out on at least once a month and selling out on a pretty consistent basis. And there were periods recently where they were out of there for like a year at a time because they couldn't go in there and put enough butts in seats to make it profitable. So the business has changed.
Yeah, well, you know, Cornette made a point. I was listening to an audio of his actually earlier today, and he, you know, somebody the question was posed to him if he had the opportunity to book. He said, "Well, you know what? They don't have bookers anymore. They have writers, and I don't know how to write. I do know how to book."
Yeah,
and,
that is so true. And that, and I have the utmost respect for Jim Cornette. He's one of I admire him as a friend, but I also have tremendous admiration for him professionally for what he's done in the business. And our backgrounds are really are very similar. That was one of the things when my book came out that, you know, a lot of times when we broke into the business, you know, we didn't talk about the things that we had done, you know, getting into the business or that we were fans at one time or what have you, because we thought that, you know, we might be looked down upon by the guys that are in the business, especially some of the tough old timers. So we didn't talk about those things. And when my book came out, I had a couple conversations, one with Jim Cornette and another one with Percy, Paul Bearer, who said, "My God, I couldn't believe the similarities in our background and how we got started in our career." So basically we were all, and I include Les in that circle too, we were all cut from the same mold. I mean, that's how we learned the business. It was the only way we knew the business. It was how it was structured and how it needed to be to perpetuate and to flourish.
You know, I think that's one of the things. I the question has come up: what do you think the movie, the Mickey Rourke movie, will do for the industry? And I said, well, probably nothing. It may get some people, to take a peek at wrestling, but it won't be the same as the movie, so they won't stick around. But I said, I think the current industry, the big two, could learn from the movie is how they studied their subject matter and filled all the credibility gaps. Because obviously I haven't seen it yet. It comes out here a week from Friday. But all the reviews I've read, and I talked to Dave Meltzer Sunday, and I said, with a wrestling match, you're supposed to suspend your disbelief. And he said, listen, and he said, in that movie, you get before you're in it 5 minutes, Mickey Rourke is no longer Mickey Rourke. He becomes Randy the Ram.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I haven't seen it either, and I'm really looking forward to it. And I've read nothing but positive reviews, too. I did hear that Vince McMahon hated it. And until I see the movie, I'm going to pass judgment on why that may be the case. But, it's
Foley put
I'm
it
just
over.
Anxious to see it, huh?
Foley put it over. Ebert gave it two thumbs up.
Yeah,
it's gotten rave reviews across the board, as far as I know. But that's it's the first. What I'm excited about, it's the first actually drama, serious adaptation of our business. No offense to present company, but Ready to Rumble was the last thing that did anything positive for the professional wrestling industry.
Yeah. Well, you know, Les, we protected the business all those years because that was what was instilled in us, because, first of all, that's how we made our living, and second of all, you can't get respect unless you command respect, and we commanded respect by doing what we did to make it so believable that we demanded that the people respect us. And I think the people that came in those days wanted to believe. And it was up to us whether we made them believe or we did foolish things or silly things or lazy, sloppy things that would cause them to feel another way. And we took tremendous pride, you know, if we had a hot match, if the crowd jumped, or if we got a particularly good response from the people, because that meant that we were doing well what we were supposed to do. And we felt like we were disappointed in ourselves if the match didn't measure up to expectations, and if the house didn't go up and went down the following week. You know, we would feel that we not only let ourselves down, but we let the fans down. We did something wrong. And that's where Jim Cornette's talking about being a booker as opposed to a writer, and it starts with the booker, but it also is with the talent that have to take the story and go out and execute it. And everybody has to be on the same page, and everybody has to be willing to, you know, to work hard. And it's a lost art. It really is. And I think today that's why, yes, out of the population there are still fans that, you know, like the current product. But I think the reason that the mixed martial arts genre is really the true competition in the industry today, because it's a real fight, and that's what people want to see, and they want to believe it's real, and they want to watch it because they think it is real. And it's just,
I'll tell you a drum that I beat that I think is a tremendous learning tool, and yours is one of them. But Sean Oliver's Kayfabe Commentaries, the guest booker series, I just finished watching Jerry Jarrett's, but yours, Gary Hart's, Jarrett's, Sullivan's, man, I think every independent promoter, wrestler, booker, whoever, should sit down and watch those things over and over, because it's all the fine details and all the do's and don'ts that, you know, would make their business at that level so much better, instead of trying to copy what they see on television.
Yeah, they're learning tools, and like Jerry Jarrett is a great example, because they had an incredible run in that Memphis Nashville territory, and I always look at the situation with the WWE, and I think part of the problem is that the final say so at the end of the line is Vince McMahon, and I don't care where you go back in the history of our business, the greatest of all the great bookers at different points got burnt out and needed to get away from it, have somebody else come in. And like I say, with Jarrett, Jerry the King Lawler would take over the book for like a 6-month run, and he would have one approach to the business that would give the look of the product kind of a different spin. And about the time that he'd paint himself into a corner, or you know, get to a point, well, where are you going to go from here? Then Jerry Jarrett would step back in with an entirely different approach to the business that was equally as entertaining, just a different approach, and give the product a fresh look. And so they were able to seesaw back and forth between the two of them. And I look at Eddie Graham in Florida, who was my mentor, but you know, whether it was Dusty or whether it was Bill Watts or whoever, he had some quality people come through. And if you look at all those people from that era, with Eddie Graham, with Dory Funk, and with Terry Funk, and with Dusty and Bill Watts, and a bunch of other names that I'm sure I'm leaving out, there's a common thread that goes back to Eddie Graham, Dory Funk Sr., you know, roots that spread out and influenced a lot of people that really spread success through our business and in many, many territories for many, many years.
Yeah, but you're right. You know, the best bookers that either one of us have ever worked for or know about, Garibaldi, Scott, Eddie, whoever, at some point they all had to step away or change territories.
Yep.
Because they at some point could not top themselves, and at some point their ideas weren't fresh anymore, and they started repeating themselves, and it put at least at worst a plateau on the business if it didn't start to taper off some.
Right, and like with Jerry Jarrett, you know, he had a formula where he could step out, come back in, and it's the same as like a Watts or a Dusty coming back, you know, having a run, getting out, going somewhere. And a lot of times that was manipulated by Eddie Graham to get Dusty out of the territory for a while, because it was healthy for the territory to get a rest from him. And then Eddie knew when the time was right to make the right phone call and tell Dusty the things that he wanted to hear and bring him back in. And Dusty would come in with renewed enthusiasm, and they would have another, you know, incredible run. But it was an incredible time for the business that, you know, sadly has passed by. And I think it's good that, you know, that the 24/7 channel, that the DVD series that are coming out with all that old footage, that's the one benefit to Vince buying up the rights to all that old video, that he's put a lot of it out there from years and years ago that maybe might not otherwise be seen. And I know from going to like the NWA Legends Fan Fest in Charlotte, I've been there for like the last 4 years, and a lot of people come there, and they, you know, there are people that remember this, you know, I mean, specifics and details of things like from 20 years ago, because it had that kind of impact on them. So that means somebody had to be doing something right.
Yeah, at that thing in Charlotte, I've said to everybody I've ever brought that up to me. I said, you know, you go in there and fans that were watching you in 1967, for God's sakes, will come up and talk to you about things you don't even remember.
That's true.
So it's amazing. Again, it goes back to the idea of detail and leaving a lasting impression. But when we were doing it back then, you never thought about it in that manner.
No.
You know,
and the fans
work
come back. They come back with books and posters and programs and what have you from that era that they've preserved those memories, like you say, often of which we've long forgotten about. But and that's very gratifying. I know for me, and I think for you too, Les, to know that after all those years that these people come back, that were fans, that because in those days we were somewhat insulated, unless you actually lived in Charlotte and happened to be in the same apartment complex with somebody in business, and even then you might not see them that often because we were on the road a lot. But
right.
We were somewhat insulated. The fans didn't have the interaction, and so when they can come to a fan fest or things like Cauliflower Alley, I became a lifetime member 3 years ago, and wish I'd have done it years and years before, because I realize how many things that I've missed out on by not seeing guys that have since passed on that I'm not going to see again, and I regret that I didn't join much sooner. And I'm also on the board of the Professional Wrestling Hall of Fame and Museum up in Amsterdam, New York, and it's a much younger organization, like, you know, 7-8 years, but it's a similar thing. You know, guys come back, and last year, I saw, you know, Johnny Rods and Pete Sanchez and some guys that I had not seen for 25
right.
years. And the same
you know, you're
thing
talking
in,
about the
Vegas.
Fan
I
thing.
I saw Les Thornton and his wife. That 25
yeah?
years.
Oh, my God. I haven't seen
Yeah, Kendo years. Nagasaki came back from Japan. So it's just the functions like the Fan Fest and Cauliflower Alley and the Pro Wrestling Hall of Fame induction weekend, and even the deal in Mobile that's closed to people in the business, the Gulf Coast. Geez, I take as much out of that as I give where the fans are involved.
Yeah, yeah, you're right. You know, one of the craziest, that first year in Charlotte, we were sitting on that up on that podium doing the autographs. A young man came by me, and gosh, I don't know, he had to be in his 30s, I guess. Young to me, but he was a mature man. But I was signing his picture, and he said, my mother carried me up to you one time, and you signed the sole of my baby shoe. And I said, really? And he said, yeah. And Alice, my wife, was sitting off the other side of the podium. I said, see that lady over there in the red? He said, yeah. I said, that's my wife. I said, go tell her. She'll get a kick out of that. And he went over and told her. And Alice said to him, well, you should have brought that shoe in with you today, had him autographed it again and dated it. He said, oh, if I try to get that out of the house, my mother would kill me.
Yeah.
But, you know, you don't, I mean, when you do things, I mean, you do things like that because that's part of what you do. And I always enjoyed the fans. I mean, a lot of guys, you know, didn't, but I realized, you know, that's, there's guys that have been to the alley that said, oh, we got to sign these autographs. These people come up. I thought, man, I don't know about you, but I feel good that somebody remembers after all.
Yeah. Well, every opportunity I get when I go to one of these functions or even when I do an interview, I always try to make a point of thanking the fans because, you know, J.J. Dillon would have not have had any level of success in the business were it not for the fans and the support, and the business itself would not have ever been what it has been and what it is today without the fans.
Yeah.
The wrestling fans are the greatest fans in the world. I mean, they talk about NASCAR fans and football fans and basketball and baseball, but wrestling fans are intensely loyal and, the greatest fans in the world.
You still there, Rich?
Yeah, yeah. I'm just waiting on
Rich,
you to
Les
over
and
to
I apologize. Les and I are living back in time. One other thing that I've never done before, I want to mention too. I've talked a couple times, and I know Les, you've done some of these seminars, and I was approached by some people up in Rhode Island that Slam Tech Wrestling. I mean, you can go online.
Yeah, Bob Evans.
Website.
Sure,
Evans,
I did one
yeah.
up there a couple years ago.
Yeah, and he's asked me to come up, and I'm going up there. It's actually Super Bowl weekend. To Westerly, Rhode Island on Saturday the 31st, and get a chance to evaluate some young talent. do some question and answer things, and they've got an event that night. So that's, you know, after all these years, after 50 years in the business, that's going to be a first for me doing one of these. And I'm
that weekend I'm going
to
be at the old ECW Arena in Philadelphia.
I hope people maybe run from one to the other.
Yes.
I would hate to compete with Les Thatcher when it comes to knowledge of the business and being able to impart that knowledge as a teacher. Les, you're a great trainer and a great student and a great historian of our business.
Well, you're a great man for saying so. And by gosh, if anybody knows talent, no, sir. You know what? These guys think we're sitting here doing the Mutual Admiration Society, but I wouldn't say it if I didn't mean it, but Jim has got one of the most fertile minds for this business. He mentioned Jim Cornette, but they both are on that same level. They both have those hair-trigger minds when it comes. I can sit down and write and make notes and scratch my head and take hours and put an angle together. And with these guys, you say, hey, this is a scenario. I kind of got roughed in. What do you think? And they'll sit and they'll wrap it up for you in a matter of 15 minutes and give you something that works. And there's very few guys around that can do that. And
that lesson. I'm like you. I've been a student of the business for 50 years. And I was smart enough in the beginning, especially because guys like you helped guide me to know enough to keep my mouth shut, to listen and absorb the knowledge of the people that were around me, and whatever success I had was because really I got a lot of help, and I interacted with really some of the greatest minds in the business, and I think that's one of the reasons that I've gotten such great feedback from my book, because I came into the business as a fan in the mid-50s, you know, not too long after, you know, wrestling had become big with television. And I lived in through the territories, and I saw the changes that came with cable television. I was Vince McMahon's right-hand man for 7.5 years and was with WCW until they closed their doors. So I really, had a unique perspective of being on the inside of the business for all of those years. And so, you know, my book is often called like Wrestling 101. That's really an explanation of how the business, you know, was structured, how the territories worked, the champion, how, you know, shows were recorded and bicycled, and how booking followed that bicycle around. And it's it's kind of like a history of modern wrestling too, through all of those stages. And even if you're not a diehard wrestling fan, I think you'd enjoy my book because it is a feel good story about a teenager from Trenton, New Jersey, that discovered professional wrestling looking on TV and fell in love with what he saw and decided that's what he wanted to do with his life. And you know, I had a lot of stumbling blocks along the way and times that I thought, you know, I wasn't going to make it, that I would end up being just a referee or whatever it was, and that I did. And I, you know, I'm living proof that dreams can come true.
You know what?
Hey, Jay, Les, can I slip in right here?
Well, you can jump in anytime you want, Tim.
Hey,
Jay,
this is Tim Dix, a lifelong fan of your work. And Rich Tate is his website, our website, GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com. He is a great historian of year by year the events that took place in the Atlanta and Georgia area. He has the actual cards and results, and they're posted on the website daily. And in 1974, you were here. You were in Georgia in 1974, along with Les Thatcher.
Yeah.
Any memories?
I'd have to go back through my journals, but I think that I don't know what the circumstances were, but I was I left Charlotte and I actually went into that territory and worked it for a little while. And I mean, I still remember that we used to do the studio show from Techwood Drive, and I think it's now one of their major corporate offices. There's like a big semi-circular rotunda with these tall pillars inside and these great murals from Gone with the Wind, and they used to put cardboard over the windows, and that's where we would have to dress. And many a Saturday morning I remember, you know, a younger Ted Turner coming in there often with the young lady on each arm. And, you know, he loved wrestling and he loved being around the wrestlers and, you know, getting a chance to see him and to meet him.
And then you would take off from there and either go to probably Carrollton, Georgia, or to Griffin, Georgia. That is where, that's my hometown, and work at the Sports Palace in Griffin, the Buddy Fuller, Roily Welch facility there. I remember seeing you wrestle there, as a matter of fact. And the one thing vividly that stands out in my mind, it was, I can't remember who you were wrestling against, but, it, you know, it's 8 or 10 minutes of you just getting into the ring. And, you know, there's plenty of,
well, plenty of heat generated there. I learned very early on, like I say, I was never the biggest and the most talented, but I knew that what I did have, whatever I had going for me, I was going to figure a way to try and get the most out of it.
You know, there were times in 73 and 74 we'd do, do the Atlanta show and then get in the car and drive like hell to Columbus.
And oh, yeah, do the live show at 4 o'clock.
And, yeah, work Fred's show at the old car barn. Yes, sir. And then catch a house show that night somewhere.
Yep. Yeah, they. I mean, they were great, great years. And again, you know, it's just another, you know, indication of how really great the wrestling fans were. Great fans down there. And I've read Rich's thing. I check out WrestlingObserver.com online every day just to see, you know, what's going on in the business and, you know, if somebody's sick or if one of the old timers has passed on. That's usually where I hear about it first. And that's a regular segment on the daily updates is Rich's results going back through various years. And I just emailed Rich the other day and told him that, you know, I think it's great that that segment's in there. And I look at the names and, oh, yes. And I know most of those guys, not way, way back, but, you know, in my ear, I know most of those guys, worked with them, wrestled some of them. And it's unfortunate that our business never figured out a way to preserve the history. I see, you know, the current fans, anytime there's one of these polls about who was the greatest wrestler, who was the greatest heel, or who was the greatest this, I mean, I have to chuckle sometimes at the percentage breakdowns that the people vote with, that they know so little about the history of our business, and so many of the great guys from the past, you know, kind of get forgotten, and it's sad. And it's nice that Rich puts that thing up every day just to kind of help preserve our history.
Well, you know, Jeff, what was your before you got into wrestling? You got in late, 29. You were a English teacher.
I taught school for a year. I was a life insurance salesman. I did a bunch of things. I worked for a casualty insurance company as a claims adjuster, investigating bodily injury claims. I got married a month out of college and had a daughter. And at that point, it's like, you know, here I went to college to get my degree because an old timer named George Bolus, the original Zebra Kid, said, "Kid, you know, get your education first because that's something they can never take away from you." And that's, you know, something that I pass along when I'm asked even today, you know, what, give me some advice. And I say, get an education. They can't ever take that away from you, and you never know when that's going to pay dividends for you. And he told me to learn the basics of wrestling. And so I went out in college for the wrestling team, and I wasn't very good, but I learned about leverage. I learned about balance and things that I applied as a professional that I thought helped give credibility to the things that I did do.
Well, I know that Rich would concur with this statement that that Bill Leedy, who's very articulate, came across very articulate, well schooled, well rounded. I think as a manager in your managing career, that education that you had prior to wrestling, it really showed. It showed, you know, that you were a well rounded human being that could look down his nose a little bit, you know.
Yeah, I always feel that everything that happened, whether it was my early years in the business and the respect that I had for the business, the fact that I had the parents that made sure that I had the opportunity to get a to get an education, to get a college degree. The fact that I refereed for 6 years. I mean, I was the third man in the ring for countless number of Bruno Sammartino's championship matches in big arenas with the likes of Killer Kowalski and Gorilla Monsoon and Ivan Koloff and Toro Tanaka. I mean, the list just goes on and on. And what a learning tool that was for me, which I didn't really understand it at the time, but I could see how these great talents that were so successful in the biggest territory in the country at that time, you know, how they listened to the people, how they reacted to the people, what they did, when they did it, and why they did it. And I just digested all of that, and those were the things that helped me. I feel I was a better performer for my experience with Les Thatcher, learning to be a good babyface. And then when I wrestled as a heel, I knew what the babyface should do because I'd been a babyface. So all of those things helped me when it came time to being a manager. It's like all the pieces came together for me. And all those years, without realizing it, I concentrated very heavily on my interviews because, as I said, I wasn't blessed with a huge physique. I wasn't something that would walk into the ring or into a room and turn heads because I just didn't have that kind of body. So I had to work to get over, and I did it more with my interviews.
Tim, you handing it over to me?
Go for it, Rich. I'm enjoying this.
Hey, JJ, I'd like to step back just a little bit and kind of clarify on what Tim was asking you about, just specifically to Georgia. You were actually in here the first time on October 26, 73, and of course I'm looking at paper. I'm not that good to pull that out of my head. But your first match here was at the Atlanta Municipal Auditorium against Tim Woods, whereas there was a stipulation where one of you had to submit to a sleeper hold. Do you remember that at all, and what led to that?
I wish I would like to tell you that I do remember it. I don't, but one of the great things of my journals, the daily logs that I kept, and, you know, every now and then I'll get them out because they were, like I say, they were a tool to help me with the telling of my life story in the book. But looking through those things, sometimes I'm amazed at the various talent that I was in the ring with over the years. I mean,
well, yeah,
Tim Woods was a huge star in the business, and you know, I go back to when I was a referee. I, as a kid, had gone to Madison Square Garden, and I had watched Dr. Jerry Graham and Eddie Graham and Bobo Brazil and Haystacks Calhoun and the Sheik and these guys. And then when I started as a referee, now I'm in the ring with these same guys that I had bought a ticket to see as a kid. And then when I started my career, I'm actually wrestling Bobo Brazil. I'm wrestling Haystacks Calhoun and the Sheik and Ernie Ladd and it was, you know, in the beginning, I'm sure it had more impact as time went on. I kind of accepted it, and I don't want to make light of it and say that it ceased to be the big deal, because it was a big deal. And as I look back and tell my life story, I realize, geez, what it really was a dream come true for me. And as I look at the list of names of guys, there were very few of the big stars in the business that I, you know, I wrestled. I had one match with Bret Hart, but I wrestled Bret Hart. I wrestled superstar Billy Graham, you know, a couple world champions. I wrestled both Funks and Jack Briscoe and Pat O'Connor after he was champion. I had one match that I talk about in my book with El Santo, who came into El Paso, you know, late in his career. He was an old man at that time, but the legend of El Santo, the original El Santo, was still alive. And I was in a tag match, and I don't remember who my partner was. I'd have to look back, with Romero and El Santo. And it ended up, you know, I dropped the fall to El Santo. And at the time, I thought, you know, it's like, you know, I'm working the territory full time, and I'm programming with Romero and Murdoch and these guys and the Funks. And, you know, and you know, why would I get beat by El Santo? Well, now as I look back, that was an honor. You know, it was an honor first to be in the ring with him and to say that I had a match with El Santo, and whether I lost the match or not is immaterial.
Yeah, you talk about just, you know, who all you were in the ring with. I mean, you know, that next morning you were in the WTCG Channel 17 studios with a match with Jack Briscoe. And the next thing, you came back in 76, and what I wanted to ask you about that period was, you came in, you were, of course, managing the Stomper at the time, And I guess kind of a two-part question: was Ole already booking here when you came in, or was he, or did he come in just shortly after that? And then secondly, what was it like to be working around Rock Hunter, who I always considered a great manager, also, who's kind of disappeared from the scene?
Yeah, he was, and of course Rock Hunter was in Charlotte when I first broke into the business too. First he wrestled at that point. I don't remember if Matty Suzuki was his partner or Pompero Furpo, but he had a regular partner because he did a lot of tag team wrestling in the Carolinas. And then later on, of course, he managed as well. But Rock Hunter was, as I look back at the list of names in the Carolinas when I broke in the business, it's like, you know, I just shake my head and realize how very, very lucky I was to break into the business at that time and to be around such great talent. Brute Bernard was there, Larry Hamilton, the Missouri Mauler, you know, Rip Hawk, Sweet Hansen, Playboy Gary Hart was there, then Jerry Briscoe, Thunderbolt Patterson, George Becker and Johnny Weaver were incredibly successful there. Sandy Scott, George Scott and Sandy had parted company, and George had gone somewhere else, and Sandy wrestled as a single. I mean Klondike Bill. I teamed up with Luke Brown, one of the Kentuckians. You know, the more I talk, the more the names keep coming back. But Johnny Heidemann, I mean, just
Frank Morrell.
Frank Morrell. Oh God, yes.
Blackjack.
Charlie Fulton.
Yes. The other thing too, Jimmy. There's a lot of guys that we worked with that were tremendous performers. That if you brought their name up now, people would look at you like, who is that again? I mean, there was so much depth on a lot of rosters and so many good workers that were just never got out of the preliminaries, you know, but were still very talented people.
Yeah, and in those days, you know, there was a healthy territory and you could make a good living. Did you get rich? No, but you know, we were all chasing a dream. We were all hoping that we would improve our skills and that we would, you know, eventually get a chance to go to New York or Minneapolis or to go to one of the bigger territories and make, you know, more money. That's really what the motivating thing was. It was and that's what differs so greatly about the business today too. Nowadays they look at a raw talent. And then they put a creative crew, costume makers, and what have you, often of which don't have any idea about the business. And sometimes Vince will say, well, let me see this guy as this. Let me see him as a plumber. Let me see him as a Viking. And, you know, and it's like they're handed a persona. And some of them, you know, like The Undertaker, you know, take with it and take it and run with it and are incredibly successful. But in those days, we created our own characters, and
yeah.
I think that was one of the nice parts of the business because the business was so diverse because we all were challenged with what could we do to make ourselves better, and we would, I think, even unconsciously, you know, you would see a move in another territory that a guy did that you thought you could do well, and when you changed territory so you weren't stealing his move, you know, you would take and incorporate that into, you know, your total performance. And over a period of time, then we all developed styles individually that made each of us individually different from everybody else. And then the interview skills, particularly, I mean, I can't conceive of somebody handing me a script because a writer has put down what they think my character would say. I mean, who would, I used to just tell me what the bullet points are. Tell me what you're trying to get over. What are we working towards? What are we trying to get to? Are you trying to get me over here to this guy? Are you trying to further this storyline? And then I would go off somewhere by myself and I would sit and that's where my mind would try to say, okay, what can I do to get these points over, but to do so in my style, so that my interview will be different than everybody else's.
Yeah.
That was a challenge, and those guys that were able to do it, you know, that contributed to their level of success in the business.
And you know, like when you bring that up about the interviews, I know when I was handling the interviews in Raleigh on Wednesday mornings and Wednesday afternoons, we were cranking out like 100, 125 spots, but I had Blackjack Mulligan, Superstar Billy Graham, Mass Superstar, Boris Malenko, Ole Anderson, Ric Flair. I mean, Lord. And there was no two alike. Everybody was entirely different. And
as you look back, they were all storytellers. You know, you mentioned like Blackjack Mulligan. Blackjack Mulligan, Dusty Rhodes, everybody was a storyteller. They had a story to tell within the box of what their character was. And that's what made that interview different than everybody else's.
Yeah. You know,
and they didn't have somebody writing for them what they needed to say and what they needed to get across.
Well, you know, it's like I had a young man ask me it's been almost a year ago now. He said he'd seen some on the old AWA, a Wahoo. And he said, and of course that was, you know, Wahoo was toward the end of his run at that point anyway. But I said, let me tell you something. I said, when that guy got a microphone and said he was going to kick some heel's ass, there was no doubt in your mind as a fan he was going to kick that guy's ass.
Exactly.
And you would pay to see it. I mean,
but in addition to that, his style was an extension of that interview. His interview was important because it indicated what he was going to do. But then if you watched any of those matches with Wahoo and Johnny Valentine and Wahoo and Flair, you know, where they would chop each other and the blood blisters would come up on the chest, you know, the Johnny Valentines of the world, you know, that's what made believers out of you. And it wasn't necessarily just the interview of Wahoo of what he was going to go out and do, but it's when he said, let's just mention, when he said he was going to go out and kick somebody's keister, when the bell rang, you knew that this was the beginning, and at some point, that's what was going to happen. And that's what you bought a ticket to see, and he never let you down.
Yeah. Well, and again, that was because, I mean, it's you know, when, like you say, Dusty was Dusty. Roddy was Roddy. Wahoo was, I mean, they were, you know, and I've always said, Jimmy, you know, in handling so many interviews for so many different people, and I don't know how to put it technically. I'm obviously no psychologist, but I believe that the guys that got over with the promos is you trigger something in the viewer's subconscious that they either buy it or they don't buy it. And if you're pitching them a bunch of crap and you're trying to be somebody you're not, then it comes across that, not consciously to them, but subconsciously, and they just kind of slough it off. They watch it, but they don't absorb it. But the guys who drew money, the guys who got over with it, were the ones who were triggering that positive sensor in that subconscious.
And you could take it a step further, and the same thing would apply to the commentators, which was why Gordon Solie was the greatest of all time, while Jim Ross is so good.
Yeah.
While you're very good, because you are able to tell the story. You're not what the people are tuning in to see. Lance Russell is another one. You were able to tell the people what they were watching in a way that helped them to see it better and to understand it. You weren't what they were tuning in to watch and see. Those were the really, really you know, great announcers in our business that again,
Bob Caudle, you could throw into that mix too.
Throw Bob Caudle in there too. Yeah, yeah.
Well, you know, we were more. JR said on his blog, I don't know when this was, but somebody had cut and pasted and sent it to me. But somebody had asked him about working with me, and he had talked about where he said we had fun. We worked Smokey together. He said, but Les was more an analyst, which I was. But then it was an extra. You know, it was like some ex football player is being an analyst opposed to just, you know, telling you what he sees on the field, and I think that lacks, with the exception of JR, that kind of lacks in the business today, period, end of story.
Yeah, well, when you look back, you know, you complimented Jim Ross because Jim Ross never had the tights on, and he may understand the business, but you give a perspective that he can't give because he hasn't been there. And when you look at Gordon Solie, he always had a Jerry Briscoe or a Buddy Colt, or he had an Eddie Graham sitting in with him, or a Jack Briscoe sitting in with him, that again, that complemented what he had to say by giving that firsthand, you know, in-ring experience.
Yeah, out there on YouTube someplace, there's the first time I ever worked with Gordon in Atlanta, and it was, I think, Woods and Watts. But anyway, some kid had seen it. He said, "You guys look so serious." I said, "We were serious. We had to be serious. We didn't welcome you to the show because we weren't doing a show. We weren't even allowed to use the word show, and we didn't laugh and cut up because we were trying to sell the product to Sirius, so we had to be serious." And, you know, that, of course, it's a lot looser today. But, you know, but you mentioned JR. Here's a guy, to me, who walks that fine. I mean, he still sells the product. He makes a mediocre product better. He's still a wrestling commentator, yet he gets across the crap that he hears coming through in his ear. He's able to walk that line, and I don't know that anybody else has.
Yeah, it's not easy. And I felt a little bad for Tony Schiavone because the hardest part was for guys that went out there every week that had to sell the current product. And how many times have you heard this is the greatest, you know, the greatest card in the history of whatever the town was? And, well, then next week has to be greater than the last one. And the product that WCW towards the end put Tony Schiavone in a horrible position that, you know, he was having to try and, you know, because that was his job, to sell something that, you know, that wasn't there. And a lot of people looked at Tony Schiavone and criticized him and what he was doing and felt that he lost his credibility. And, you know, he just was trying to do his job. But also the same thing applies to managing. It's like, you know, my job in the corner, I was the catalyst to get people hopefully to buy tickets to see the match. They didn't come to buy tickets to see me. They came to buy tickets to see who was in the ring, and I hoped I furthered the story or created a spin on it or excitement that maybe motivated people to come there. And when they got there, you know, my job was to, not to be the focus of attention, but to help where I was needed, when I was needed, but never the focus of attention. But one thing that I always did do, and I always took the philosophy that less is more. I didn't have to do a lot, but what I did do, I tried to do at the right time and have impact. And that's why I enjoyed some level of success. But at the same time, I never lost interest in the match. As I'm there, I'm being cocky and arrogant when the heel I'm managing is showboating and doing his thing, and when the babyface is making the comeback, every time he gets clocked, I'm selling with him and I'm feeling that pain. And my thinking is the people that bought the ticket in the front row, if they look at me and I'm not interested in everything that happens in that ring, how can I expect them to be interested?
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, you're talking about that TV thing. I know Taz and I had this conversation a couple of years ago, and I said, "Man, I don't know how I don't know if I could work with somebody talking in my ear constantly." I mean, we had headphones or earpieces, but it was the director giving you a time cue or somebody saying, "Don't forget to plug Macon," or something like that. But I never, you know, whether it was Cottle, whether it was JR, whether it was Gordon, we'd sit down in a production meeting and we had a format. And nobody gave us 15-page scripts. And, okay, here's this match, Rich Tate against J.J. Dillon. Okay, whoever the booker happened to be, what do you want out of this? Well, you know, we got to get J.J. over because he's just coming. Okay, we make a note, get J.J. over. You know, just make notes in the margins of our format, for God's sakes. And then it was us being creative. We build it off of what we saw.
Yeah, absolutely.
And they've taken that away from everybody but JR, too. You know, you hear some of the things coming out of these guys' mouths, and you just know that somebody, you know, put it there because it's so. Sometimes it's just so, I don't know.
What is interesting to me is I don't watch the current product anymore, and there's sometimes that I do turn around. And the other night I did happen to catch, and I don't know what night it was. It might have been Monday night, I guess, whatever the programming is on Monday. And I saw a tag match on TV with Shawn Michaels and John Cena against Orton and Chris Jericho. And I stopped and I watched and I realized, you know, it was like stepping back in time. That here were four guys who obviously were very talented.
Right.
That were the cream of the crop of their crew, and everybody working in harmony with each other, and everybody doing, you know, what was expected to get the match over. And I have to say, for the 10 minutes that I stopped and watched the match to the end of its conclusion, it was like stepping back in time, that these are guys that, even if it's unconsciously, certainly with Barry Orton, it's in his genes going back, you know, several generations. But, you know, these are guys that were no different than Les, you and I, that have obviously been around the business for a while, have watched and learned, and have the ability to still have the ability to execute. My concern is, when these guys move on and retire, who's going to take their place?
There you go. Yeah, that's, you know what, that's everybody's concern, I think, Jimmy, and it is a major concern, because with the lack of the territories, there's no learning place. And again, to paraphrase Cornette, he was saying that when they, you know, one of the big problems, well, with my place here and with OVW, was that they wanted done what they wanted done, and they didn't care how that affected us. And we were trying to teach guys to work, and we were putting the best performers on our television, and they wanted to see somebody couldn't slap their rear end with both hands, because that's who, you know, who they, for some reason, he had a cute grin or funny haircut, or he made funny faces, and that's what they thought was important. And now they're, you know, Jimmy asked this on this audio, as you know, he said, who have they turned out in the last 3 years? And the interviewer was stuck for an answer. Jimmy said, thank
you. The other thing, too, is in the history of our business, Les, there was, I think, in every era, if you asked a wrestling fan, or if you asked a casual fan, when you think of professional wrestling, what name comes to mind? And you go back into the 50s, and like everybody knew who Gorgeous George was.
Sure.
Or
Rocca,
know, Rogers. Argentina Rocca, or Buddy Rogers, right, and Kowalski. And then, you know, in New York later on, if you talked about wrestling, Bruno, everybody knew who Bruno Sammartino was.
Sure.
Hulk Hogan came along, and people said, who's, you know, wrestling? Oh, you mean Hulk Hogan. You know, and now, in this era right now, if you talk to a wrestling fan, or like I say, a casual fan, and say, I'm going to say professional wrestling, what name immediately comes to mind? And you get that silence, because you don't have that marquee. You know, Rock certainly was there for a while, and Stone Cold Steve Austin was there for a while too.
Yeah.
But you don't have, you know, some will say Cena, but for some reason there's a lot of people that don't like Cena. You know, I don't know.
Well, you know, I think part of that is he's a good kid, and he's a great promo. He's got a great look. He's got a lot of fire. He's just not he's not a great in-ring performer. He's got a few set moves, and that's it. And I think, you know, but I think part of his this, where people don't like him, is a lot of young guys are mad because their young girlfriends like him, you know.
Yeah.
And he catches that sort of Elvis Presley type heat, right?
Yeah.
My girlfriend likes you, so I've got to hate you.
Well, that's where Ric Flair, I think, was very unique, in that he was a guy that the girls loved and went woo when he went woo, and the guys went woo because they wanted to be like him and weren't mad because the girls liked him. But in most cases, that formula didn't work. The guys would get mad if the girls, you know, liked the guy. But Rick had crossover appeal that it just seemed like everybody liked him. The boys wanted to be like him, and the girls wanted to love him.
Yeah, you know, I told a young guy just the other day who was, one of the guys I'm going to work with up in Philadelphia at the end of the month, he was saying, you know, talking about a couple clubs that he said, I'm a heel. He said, I'm a strong heel. But he said, some of the people are kind of cheering for me. And I said, let me tell you something. Over the last 48 plus years that I've been in this business, I said, some of the guys that ended up being the strongest baby faces were the strongest heels.
Yeah,
and
you get
to a certain
bruiser.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, JJ, you know, we're gonna wrap it up here, because we are getting toward our last few minutes. I just want to say what a great honor it's been to have you on here tonight, and I want to go ahead and make an announcement that we held up until now. For those listening to the show, we want to let you know that JJ has agreed to join us for recurring Wayback segments. We are going to start the Wayback Machine up here again soon, and joining Bobby Simmons who will be doing those once a month. So too will JJ.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to that. I was concerned. I've been asked at other times to do something like this, and I respect what Rich has done with preserving the history of the business, and I just think that there's so much that can talk about, and the hard thing for me is to keep it short and sweet. You know, we've been on, and I apologize, Les and I think have dominated the conversation, but it's so great to be able to talk about the glory years of the business, because I know I'm proud, and I know Les is too, and it's just a great time in the business and fun to talk about.
It most certainly is, and I know I'm sure Tim's got some closing thoughts here with you as we head out this way. Tim?
Well, one quick question, JJ. When the Four Horsemen became the Four Horsemen, in retrospect, who was the? Of course, Flair was the champion, and everybody was protecting him. But who really carried the load, do you think? I mean, in retrospect, who really made the Horsemen over the length of the first the original cast?
I think it was a spontaneous thing that came together. Ric Flair was the world champion. Tully was the national champion. Ole and Arn were world tag team champions. So you got a group of guys who were already successful in the business. It wasn't like, you know, somebody trying to tie on the coattails of somebody else to elevate him. And I only managed Tully at the time. And Arn just... We all went out there for one interview on the WCW Saturday afternoon show that ran for so many years, and nobody knew what Arn was going to say, and he said, you know, take a good look at your screen, because we had all the belts, all the bragging rights, and he said, never, you know, you fans at home, take a good look at your screen, because never in the history of the business have so few wreaked so much havoc on everybody else. You'd have to go back in history to the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse and held up four fingers, and that's how it started, and it really was the fans that made it.
And you know what? That was not only, but that was the greatest faction. Still, I think I don't care. You can throw out anybody else you want, but that still was because, like Jimmy says, they just all clicked. It was just
and we
spontaneous
enjoyed.
Thing.
We generally enjoyed being around each other, and there were no ego clashes. And you know, anytime you have that many people spending as much time together as we did, you know, between traveling, being in the dressing room, ring time, and then partying way into the night, much later than I probably should have been on many nights. I should have been in bed. But trying to stay up with Ric Flair, you know, probably has taken a few years off my life, but it was also a wonderful time in my life that I look back with great memories.
Well, one thing I can tell you about the Horsemen is to this day, there are people still on message boards who try to build a Four Horsemen of today. And who today would be in the Four Horsemen. So obviously, you know, a little flattery going back to you guys, but I can tell you that I've never seen a Four Horsemen of today that would rival the original.
No, imitation is the greatest form of flattery, and I think Cornette has said, you know, a lot of things often imitated but never duplicate the original.
That's right.
I think Horseman is a synonymous word in wrestling as a headlock or a figure four. It is part of the wrestling lexicon, and I mean, when you've made it to that level, you know, that no explanation necessary.
Well, guys, I've enjoyed this time. Welcome fans to check my website, jjdillon.com. I've got a lot of great old pictures on there, and a lot of candid shots with some of the new stars of today, and a chance to check out my book, my autobiography, and read what it's all about. And most importantly, go to the review section of people that have already read the book and read their comments. And, you know, that might help you make a decision if you don't already own a copy.
Yeah, if you don't own it, you're an idiot.
You should. I got one, too.
This is one of the best wrestling books ever. Literally, I've read it, like, I know, six times. And I may have even lost count. Anyway, JJ, great to have you, and we'll be getting in touch with you soon about when we get the Wayback thing started back up and when your next appearance will be.
Well,
Jimmy, always a pleasure, my friend. I love you, buddy.
The pleasure's been all mine, and Happy New Year again to you and everybody that's there, and Happy New Year to all the great fans that are listening.
All right, man. You take care and have a good night.
All right, thank you.
All right. Guys, that was definitely very interesting. You know,
that's a bombshell.
Well, what's that?
Bombshell announcement.
Yeah.
We now have a manager.
You should have had it. We need sound effects for that with the bomb.
We'll see. We're gonna restart the Four Horsemen right here on PSP.
Okay.
Guys, any last thoughts? We got about 30 seconds left.
You mean there's time left?
Actually, let me go ahead and do this. Let me just say this was a great show tonight. Glad to be back, and let me go ahead and plug the next thing coming up on the GWH Radio Network is this Saturday. Me and Dave Meltzer, 9 o'clock p.m. Eastern. Talking about TNA's Genesis, which takes place on Sunday. So we'll be doing that and probably talking a little bit more about the papers from Waxman and seeing where that thing's going. So everybody have a good night. Have a good week. Look for us on Saturday night. And Les, Tim,
we'll see you next week.
Good night, everybody.
All right.
We thank you for listening to this broadcast brought to you by the GWH Radio Network. Be sure to stay tuned to GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com for information on upcoming shows, as well as all the news and information you could ever need and want. As always, GWH thanks you for your continued support.